Hampshire took a small but significant step toward deciding whether it should privatize its prisons. 2 weeks ago, the Executive Council approved funds to pay a consultant who will help the state evaluate proposals from four prison contractors. Their ideas could range from simply building a facility and leasing it to the state to almost complete private management. This process was set in motion last year under the state budget, which told the Department of Corrections to examine how privatization might work and how it might stack up against the current system. Once the consultant's work is done, the findings will be presented to the governor and the executive council, who will decide upon the next step. But if one of these private proposals were chosen, the public might demand to be involved, as this could represent a major policy shift for the state. And opinions on privatization are mixed. In our citizen legislature, for example, some support it as a way to save money and innovate corrections, but others have strong reservations, especially over whether a profit-making enterprise can be committed to closing that revolving door of inmate recidivism when more prisoners means more money for the company. Today in The Exchange, public and private prisons, the debate returns to the Granite State. Let's hear from you. Should New Hampshire have some or all of its facilities privately run? Could cost savings or innovation result from this? Or do you think the motives of a for-profit company are incompatible with society's goals for corrections? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests for the hour. Joining us by phone is Harris Kenny, policy analyst with the Reason Foundation, a think tank that promotes libertarian principles and free markets. And Harris Kenny, welcome back to The Exchange. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me on. Good to be back.
Also with us, Eric Lotke, senior research analyst in the public division of the Service Employees International Union, which represents 2 million workers. Prison employees are among its members. And Eric Lotke, welcome to The Exchange, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, gentlemen, just starting off, you know, as I talked about New Hampshire, exploration here is in the very early stages. Four proposals on the table that will be analyzed. But to you first, Harris, what do you think is driving the interest in this privatization possibility here in New Hampshire and really in many other states around the country?
Well, the debate is driven by a pretty simple problem, which is that there's not a lot of money in state legislatures. And that's the primary driver. On a secondary level, people are looking at, legislators and elected officials are looking at ways to reinvent their correctional systems. But the primary driver is cost. And I think that's a consistent narrative at both the state and federal level.
Well, and I want to get Eric into this, but I'm curious what you mean, Harris, by reinvent corrections. Give us a little more there, please.
Well, the traditional correctional model is that the legislature passes laws, people go through the system, and they come out. It is not a lot of questions about what happens inside of those prisons, why the prison is looking that way. And the sort of corrections 2.0 model that they are talking about in Florida and that New Hampshire may be able to look at, although I haven't read about it yet, would be that you really look at integrating incentives into the system, into wellness programs, and specifically higher rewards with private operators for doing a better job for keeping inmates out of jail. Performance-based rewards, which may finally fix this incentive problem that we have in the correctional system.
Well, and we'll definitely get into that. Yeah,
so I don't want to oversell what's happening, but that's being talked about.
Definitely want to follow up with you a little bit later, Harris, on that idea of writing the contract so that you can have performance-based goals in it. But Eric Lotke, what do you think? What's driving this interest that we see in New Hampshire and other states in privatizing all or some parts of prisons?
Well, clearly cost is driving it, and people are worried about money every place. And there's this idea that the private sector can do things better and cheaper and faster, and that's just this idea that's out there in the atmosphere. And, of course, in many cases, it's right. The private sector is good at a lot of things. And corrections happens not to be one of them. And this is not a new idea. There's actually 20, 30 years of experience at this by now, where the private prisons are not cheaper. They come out roughly breaking even in cost, sometimes a little bit more expensive, sometimes maybe $5 cheaper. But they're basically breaking even in cost. And what happens is that the way they reduce their costs is by underpaying their staff and understaffing their facilities. So that does, in fact, cut the cost. But they have multimillion-dollar CEO pay. They owe profits to shareholders. And those kinds of things push up costs in a way that the public prisons don't have, in the end, there's 20 years of data at this. They roughly break even in cost. They routinely have performance problems. And Harris talks about innovation, but there really isn't any innovation here. The person is sentenced for a year, and a year takes a year, no matter who manages it. And if you want to have programs and things, we all want to have programs in education and those kinds of things in prisons. And the public sectors can, and in many cases do, provide them. And in the private sector, if they're contracted, you can perhaps require them to provide them. But again, the experience is that they will do as little as they can possibly get away with. And so it becomes this monitoring enforcement problem. You said you were going to do it, but you didn't do it. You said you were going to have even simple things like perimeter lighting and security guards. And in many cases, they fail at the perimeter lighting. They fail at the security guards. And there are more escapes. There's more violence, inmate-on-inmate, inmate-on-staff. There's all of these performance problems, and what they're fundamentally tied to is that the facilities are understaffed, the people are underpaid, and there isn't the same long-term commitment to corrections management by the people who are there, because fundamentally the corporation owes a duty to shareholders. That's its fundamental obligation, and the prison operates like that. And then there are all kinds of problems, and we see them again and again.
Well, and we'll definitely dig into those this hour. But I just wanted to clarify one thing before we go any further. And Harris, to you. So this subject gets lots of play in the media. We're talking about it now. We've talked about it before. And yet, Harris, I have read that less than 10% of prisoners in the U.S. are in private facilities. First off, is that correct?
Yes, it is. At the federal and state combined, it's only 8%.
Yeah. And why do you think that's the case, Harris?
Well, over time, over the last 20 years, the proportion of the private sector has grown. But I think the way the states are using the private sector is basically as a relief valve. They're saying, look, once we develop in-house the ability to write these contracts, it gives us more control. And if we need to, we can ratchet back. If we don't like what we're seeing, we don't re-sign the contract. And so it's seen as a relief valve. It's not, the private sector isn't dominating corrections. I mean, the public sector runs 92% of the prisons, but they also write the laws, and they also do the law enforcement, and they run the courts, and they do parole, and they do drug sentencing. So any problems with corrections should be attributed to the lack of transparency and lack of focus on good outcomes in the public sector, and that includes elected officials, courts, law enforcement. I mean, this is a big problem. Private prison operators are a pretty small fish in the pond.
Well, and let me invite our listeners to join us. And then lots more questions for both of you. Our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us today in the Exchange as we look at the possibility of privatizing prisons. There's been a lot of talk about this in New Hampshire lately as the governor and others explore this idea. Join us with your questions and thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Also, the Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our Facebook page and join the conversation there. And gentlemen, lots of comments by email and from Facebook and on the phones. And here's one that came in from Sarah on Facebook. She says, research has shown that a for-profit model only increases costs, because it is about profits, and is a disincentive for prisoners to get rehabilitated, if that is even an option. Time and time again, she says, we have seen the real-world statistics show that it will cost more. Could we, Harris and Eric, get to that fundamental point? I've got a couple emails on the same point. People feel uncomfortable with the idea of a profit motive when, if the prisons are empty and you're doing a good job helping people not commit crimes, the company's not making money. So, Harris, can you deal with that first, that philosophical issue about what incentive does a private company have to reduce inmate recidivism if the bottom line depends on full prisons?
Sure. Well, I'll say institutionally, at Reason, we strongly support revisiting the war on drugs and, frankly, ending it. And a lot of people are in jail for victimless crimes. So I think first, philosophically, it's safe to say that a lot of people just shouldn't be there in the first place. And I think that's important to remember, again, that the fact that the public sector elected officials are deciding to lock people up. I think that's important. The second question about profit, you know, it's about profit versus benefit. I mean, you could say a for-profit company is benefiting through profits, but the public sector is benefiting through a tough-on-crime, lock-them-up, we'll-keep-you-safe mentality. And so the elected officials may not be making a profit, but they're getting reelected, and department officials get promoted through this philosophy of lock them up and tough on crime. There's no clear, I mean, academic research goes both ways on cost savings. So I'm not going to sit here and say private sector will save you money every time. That's not clear. What you do get is a clear all-in cost. When they bid, every single cost goes into their daily cost for inmates, and everything is in the contract. So there is a unique burden there, but the public sector can handle it.
Yeah, and Eric, I want to ask you about that. But just, again, the moral dilemma, though, Harris, that I've gotten from a lot of listeners even before the program, that if your bottom line is better when the prison is more full, what incentive do you have to truly rehabilitate people?
Well, this speaks to the second point, which is this Corrections 2.0 idea, performance-based. You reward operators for people that don't go back to jail. And I would also, again, just kind of zoom out and say, looking just at for-profit operators doesn't fully answer the question of what about the whole system that benefits from people being locked up. And the system that benefits is, by and large, a public system that has nothing to do with corporations, that has nothing to do with executive pay, and that has nothing to do with the profits or capitalism or anything like that.
Benefits, again, as you said, Harris, being not money in this instance, but that you get elected and that you have a good image as tough on crime.
Exactly. For protecting children, protecting communities, etc.
Well, and Eric, I want to ask you about that, but we're heading into a break. So we will take that question after a short break. You can join us in the meantime at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're looking at prison privatization today on The Exchange, and should the Granite State shift some or all of its corrections functions to a private company? Let us know what you think about that. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. PR or email us exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
It's 9:19. It's The Exchange on NHPR. Good morning. NHPR is offering a reprieve from some of the summer gas prices. The early bird prize for our summer car raffle is $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil. That could last you up to a year, and $50 is all it takes to get in the running. Get your tickets at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from the 79th Annual League of New Hampshire Craftsmen's Fair, August 4th through the 12th at the Mount Sunapee Resort in Newberry. Information online at nhcrafts.org. And from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, creating eco-friendly and healthy sleep environments. Also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the debate over whether New Hampshire should privatize some aspects of the state prison system. We invite your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. The Exchange is now on Facebook, too, so we hope you'll go to our Facebook page and join the conversation there. And Eric Lotke, just before the break, we were talking with Harris Kenny about this moral concern that many listeners bring up, which is they worry that a for-profit company can't have the goals of society in mind in terms of, lowering recidivism, making sure that people don't reoffend, because their bottom line is enhanced when the prisons have more people. But, Harris has raised a point that I have read elsewhere, Eric, and that is states can write in their contracts, we won't pay you until we have good outcomes, better rehabilitation, lower recidivism. I've read they're looking at this in Florida and in Britain. So can this problem be overcome, Eric? What do you think?
I think it actually can't, and it can't for a bunch of reasons. First of all, at the micro-operational level, the monitors can never be there in the way that they would need to be. And the incentive is really real, and although Kenny is right that the public writes the law, the legislators write the law, it's also true that the private prison companies make political donations, they give money to party committees, they give money to people who run advertisements, who make the tough-on-crime environment the way it is, so it's harder to go look for the alternatives to incarceration. The real 2.0, which is why are there so many people locked up? What about the drug treatment for the nonviolent offenders? What about mental health counseling? What about things that don't happen behind bars at a cost of $33,000 a year in New Hampshire? That's the real 2.0. And the kind of 2.0 that Harris is talking about inside of the bars, nothing about that is new. It's really quite traditional that if you behave well, you'll get paroled. If you behave badly, you have more time in your cell, you lose the exercise, you can't take part in the programs and the education. Those incentives are really, really traditional. And there's something else that's different here, which is back to that 8%, where it's only a relatively small number of the prisons are private in the country. And by the way, while the number was has been growing over the last, call it, 20 years, in recent years, enough states have had enough bad experiences that they're actually bringing people back in-house. And one of the problems in New Hampshire is it's really looking at privatizing almost the entire system all at once.
Well, we don't really know. There's four proposals on the table, and they could range, you know, they could have a number of levels of privatization. It's just getting started in the process.
No, the process could, a contract could be leased, you know, like 2 months from now. Like, it's potentially quite late if the Executive Council votes on one of those contracts. It could actually happen that way. Many people hope that it won't. But New Hampshire is a small system. There's 2,500 people in prison right now, and a lot of these prisons are proposing 2,500 beds. There's news articles about 3,000 beds. And, well, we'll bring in more people by importing from Vermont and Maine. It'll make a tri-state prison. And, again, without the real public discussion of the import-export business. But New Hampshire is a small state, and we're really only talking about one prison, and that's really all the state needs. In other states where there's lots of prisons and they experiment with one private prison, and it takes a couple of rounds, some back and forth before the contract terms are right, when they start moving some inmates into this kind of prison and others into that kind of prison, and then in some cases they can cancel and walk away. And in New Hampshire, we're really in a situation where, because it's small and this really would tend to happen roughly all at once, one 2,000-bed prison in there, that's practically everybody, and it guarantees, the RFP is talking about a guarantee of 80% occupancy over 20 years. So we are really locked in an important way that doesn't allow the kind of marketplace back and forth, this worked, that didn't work, you know, it stinks, I'm exiting entirely.
Eric,
can't happen the way it's being built there.
Yeah, and I think that there's still a lot we don't know, since this is really just getting started here in New Hampshire. But since you're raising the process here in the Granite State, let's go now to Andy Sanborn. He represented Henniker in the state Senate until resigning in June to run in his new home district of Bedford. While in the Senate, though, Andy Sanborn supported efforts to develop a plan for privatizing the State Department of Corrections. And Senator Sanborn, thanks for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Laura, as always, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I know that you're not directly involved in this right now at this point in time, but do you have a sense, Senator Sanborn, of where the state is at in this exploration of private prisons?
Sure. You know, Laura, I think at some level we need to back up and look at somewhat of the overall picture of what's happening and why we're looking at it. You know, as you know, I was on a committee to look at the big question, should we privatize and why? So when we started this, we look at the fact that we had 300 people in prison in 1980. It's exploded to today. I think we have about 2,250 in prison. We're spending about $40,000 to $50,000. And again, the reason I provide that roundness is because every state, including New Hampshire, seems to have a difficult time including all of their expenses into what it costs.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that's say $47,000 to $50,000 per prisoner. Our county actually is spending $65,000 a year per prisoner. But then when you look at states like Texas spending $21,000 and Florida spending $19,000. So I think the first question really comes down to cost and are we being effective and frugal with taxpayers' money. Now, in addition to that, we start going into the second half, which you've been talking about in the first half of your show, about, you know, how do we rehabilitate? How do we get our population down? Who are the right people that should be in or shouldn't be in? So there's no question it's very complex.
Well, how do you feel about the moral concern that we talked about, Senator Sanborn, that a for-profit company doesn't have the right motives to run a prison because they make money when the prisons are full? What do you think about that? It's a big question.
You know, I think it is a question, but not the largest question. I mean, I think the largest question is whether or not we are trying to rehabilitate people and trying to ensure that, after they have, done their time, per se, can we get people back out into society and make sure that they can become integrated and not commit crimes again? For me, it's like suggesting that we should privatize all of our hospitals, because are you suggesting that for-profit hospitals are giving worse care to people than private hospitals? And I'm not sure that's the case that can be made today.
What about the process here in New Hampshire? Where are we at, Senator Sanborn? As I understand, there's a contractor who's helping the state make its way through all these very complicated proposals from four private companies. Is that your understanding of where we're at now? I mean, nobody's saying New Hampshire's going to do this for sure.
Yeah, and personally, in being on the committee that started this process, I can tell you, after having sat through days upon days upon days of hearings, I'm not even at a point where I could make a recommendation of what we should do.
Uh-huh.
So we really still should be in that investigatory stage, because it raises questions, as some of your earlier callers said, do you pack them all up and ship them all out? Do you hire a private company to run the prisons we have in New Hampshire today, acknowledging that, one of our prisons was built in 1878 and it's truly falling apart? Do we find someone to come in and build a brand new prison, or do we continue with the process that we already have? We also need to look about the fact that you've got some prisoners that are in, minimum security, but then you've also got people that, that we have six prisoners, not prisoners, people locked up because they're incompetent to stand trial for heinous sexual crimes. We're spending $1.2 million just on those. We've got dozens upon dozens of people in prison with severe medical issues, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on dialysis.
Yeah, as the population ages, the prison population ages, it gets more and more expensive. One last question for you, Senator Sanborn, please. From what I have read, so far this is really in the hands of the executive council, the governor, the heads of administrative services and corrections. What about, though, the legislature, the voice of the people in this process, so to speak? Do you guys get involved at all or not?
I think we did get involved, and I think we will be intimately involved with this, because although the executive council and the governor really works on the contractual portion of it,
right,
Remember, it's the legislature that actually doles out the money. All of the hearings that we had and conversations were open to the public, and I think we had really good public input from both sides of the equation. But at the end of the day, as we start looking towards new budgets, as we do budgets every 2 years in our state, it's the legislature that will determine the budget. So I think you'll find there will be significant public input and time and discussion for it.
All right. Well, Senator Sanborn, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
As always, I truly appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye. Andy Sanborn represented Henniker in the state Senate until he resigned in June to run in his new home district of Bedford. And as we heard, while in the Senate, he worked on plans for prison privatization. Our number for you to join us right now with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And gentlemen, let's go first to Doris in Bristol. Hi, Doris. You're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. My name is Doris Dumont, and I am on the Citizens Advisory Board of the Men's Prison in Concord, New Hampshire. My husband, Robert Dumont, is also on the advisory board, and we've been on the board since its inception, many, many years, 12 or 13 years.
So what are your thoughts, Doris, about privatization? I understand you're deeply involved, so please, I'm interested in what you think.
And we're also on the advisory board of the statewide advisory board for the whole department. I have grave concerns about privatizing the prisons. My husband and I have been to prison systems all over this country, and we're always proud that we're from New Hampshire. My husband worked for many years as a consultant for the PREA Commission doing trainings, and for the Justice Department doing trainings in other prison systems.
Well, what are your concerns about, Doris?
Well, I'll tell you, we've always been proud that New Hampshire is such a progressive system, and I have no idea. I have grave concerns about the motives behind doing this. New Hampshire does a great job for a small amount of money, the reason we have so many people in prison compared to the 1980s is because we privatized, for one reason, we privatized all of the mental health facilities in the 70s, and all of those people, many of them ended up homeless, and the rest of them ended up in prison.
Sure, and you know, we've covered that a lot on this program. But to her concerns, grave concerns, Harris Kenny, as she said, she's pleased that we don't privatize and feels like, seems like she's saying our prisons are more humane than those who are privately run. I wonder what you think, Harris.
Well, it's true that, I guess as far as humanity, it's difficult to say exactly what the concern there is. I mean, these contracts are very robust, and in some states there's actually a 24/7 monitor, either through camera or on-site. And so I'm not sure what the specific concern is or what specifically she's afraid of. I mean, that's kind of the point of the contract, is that it's in there. What I can say is that New Hampshire is a well-run system, and its recidivism rate has been falling for the last 4 years, and it's recidivism rate is now in line with the national average, around 40, mid-40s. And I think that's why they're proceeding with caution. I think that's why they're bringing in an over-the-shoulder private sector group to help understand the process. And they may decide that New Hampshire doesn't need to do any privatization. But it certainly doesn't hurt to ask, and it certainly doesn't hurt to think, might we be able to do this better?
Well, and Senator Sanborn talked about some of the costs here in New Hampshire, and they are high. I'm just curious, Harris, where do companies often find cost savings that public sector prisons are not doing?
Well, it depends. It depends on the facility. National companies tend to have best practices that they put in place that state departments of corrections don't have time to develop. They look at staffing issues. They look at capital investment and a variety of measures. But I mean, it's not like they're turning it from a world-class facility into a concrete box. They work with the state DOC Department of Corrections, and that relationship is normally very collaborative between the contracting process and all that. So it really depends on what the state wants. I mean, if the state wants them to spend money somewhere, the state can ask them to. And that's, I think, why they brought in this over-the-shoulder contractor to help navigate procurement here.
Well, we have another state senator joining us now, Sylvia Larson, state senator from Concord, a Democrat, who has served as chair of the Interagency Coordinating Council for Women Offenders. And Senator Larson, welcome back to you on the exchange. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, how do you feel, given your work on this coordinating council, how do you feel broadly, Senator Larson, about exploring the idea of prison privatization?
I'm very concerned, and actually we sent, as a coordinating council, sent a letter to the governor and executive council expressing our concerns with privatization because, I mean, the biggest point is when you introduce the profit motive into our prison system and our correctional system, you introduce a motive for increasing or keeping populations at a steady level. Our goal has been, and I served also on the Justice Reinvestment Program here in the state a couple years back, our goal has been to reduce our recidivism rate and return fully integrated folks into the community through a greater emphasis on community supervision once they're out. We've had a very high recidivism rate. We are bringing it down because we've focused on greater community supervision once folks are out. But it is an ongoing process, which I think would be terminated if we ended up with private prisons that were seeking to fill their beds.
You know, I'm wondering on the other side of that profit motive, though, and we've heard concern from our listeners about that. Is there, though, in that profit motive, a spark for innovation, a spark for cost savings that we're not thinking about right now because we're just doing it the way we've always done? Senator Sanborn was with us a couple minutes ago, and he said it's $40,000 to $50,000 a year to incarcerate someone. That's a lot of money.
I think the idea that there would be greater innovation in the private system is not necessarily proven out. There was a study done by Elaine Rizzo and Dr. Hayes, on privatization and the risks, assessing the risks and benefits of prison privatization. I'm not sure that they found greater innovation. They did find lower payment to those who are serving on the staff in private prisons. They found they're there. Of course, they may maintain what we're doing, but I'm not sure you see greater innovation as a result. In fact, two states which did go to privatizing have, in fact, eliminated their contracts with the private prisons. New Hampshire, I think, might have been, if we do this, would be the only state that would go 100% into privatization. Well, and personally, I don't have a problem with a private industry coming up and building us a prison, but I think if we count on them to operate it, we don't get cost savings and we don't get greater safety.
Yeah, that's the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, again, this is very early. Contracts, proposals are just being looked at. So it sounds like there are some lower levels of privatization, Senator Larson, that might be okay. You know, have them come in and build it, but have the state run it.
And that I think is a possible alternative. We've had difficulty in our capital budget finding what we know is the necessary. Even the women's prison alone cost $26 million. We know we need a new women's prison, but when you look at all the alternatives for what we need to maintain in our capital budget, the prisons keep going on the lower end of the priority list. So I think if we could find a private entity that wanted to build and lease, it might be something which we could look at, and it might mean that we'd move more quickly into an upgraded facility, which would allow for greater kind of skill training and industry planning and schooling that will, in fact, reduce our return rate to the prisons, because we'll be releasing people who've had greater skill training while they're incarcerated.
Well, Senator Larson, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Sylvia Larson, state senator and a Concord Democrat, who served as chair of the Interagency Coordinating Council for Women Offenders. After a short break, we'll talk more and we'll take more of your calls and emails, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page, and we'll be right back.
It's 9:39. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Cedar Crest Center for Children with Disabilities, enriching the lives of children with complex medical and developmental needs and supporting their families. CedarCrestCenter.org. And from Mount Washington Cog Railway, featuring hourly excursions to the summit of New England's highest peak on steam or eco-friendly biodiesel trains. Schedule and tickets at thecog.com. This is NHPR.
$2,000 in Irving Oil Gas gift cards is just the early bird prize in NHPR's summer car raffle. You'll also have a chance to win a kayak from Portsmouth Kayak Adventures, a bike, and a cargo rack for your car from S&W Sports. And the grand prize is your choice of a Ford Fusion or a Toyota Prius, donated in part by Grapponi Automotive Group. Raffle tickets are just $50 at 1-888-805-NHPR or nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, we take a look at the U.S. Supreme Court and its role in American government. Email us at nhpr.org before the program and join us Monday morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at prison privatization as New Hampshire is just beginning to examine bids from four companies on the possibility of privatizing some aspects of our corrections system. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Harris Kenny, policy analyst with the Reason Foundation, and Eric Lotke, senior research analyst in the public division of the Service Employees International Union. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And Eric Lotke, just to follow up with you on something Senator Larson said, she seemed to say it's fine if a private company wants to come in and build the prison as long as the state manages it, runs it. What do you think? Is there some level of privatization, Eric, that sounds okay to you?
Well, building is a very simple thing. And so, in fact, if the state were building a prison, it would hire private contractors to do it. You know, it doesn't
right.
do that fully internally. If it hires a private prison company to build it, really the only difference is the financing. It comes out of the operating part of the budget, not the capital part of the budget. In the end, over a 20 and 30-year time horizon, it probably ends up costing the state a little bit more to lease it back from the private company, but it doesn't have to. There doesn't have to be a bond issue, and you don't have to. It doesn't come out of the capital part of the budget, so it looks like a savings in that way. But basically, hiring a company to build a prison is just fine, right? Hiring it to build and then lease back probably costs a little more over 30 years, but you do have these cash flow problems that you solve right now, so that's all fine. It's the operating that really becomes different, because operating is really where these incentives come in that people are right to worry about, because the company needs to make it filled full, and the contract will probably guarantee an occupancy rate, and about the savings and the staff pay. In the Adams County facility in Mississippi, the CCA, Corrections Corporation of America prison, they just had a big riot. An officer died, and other officers were saying, I was paid $9.76 an hour. Of course it's not working very well. And we hear this repeatedly. We see the staff pay problems, the understaffing problems that ultimately lead to performance problems, lots of escapes.
Public safety issues. So low pay equals high turnover equals public safety problem. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Well, how do you feel, Eric, about the criticism, though, that unions are against privatization no matter what because they want to preserve corrections officers' jobs, which are usually union jobs? I mean, do you have sort of a vested interest here?
I think that's right, and we have the same vested interest, and I just have to say it, but I don't want to harp. Reason Foundation gets money from CCA and GEO, the private prison companies, and I'm not holding that against them either. And so we have an interest in keeping our members employed, but we don't care where they're employed. They could be employed in drug treatment. They could be employed in mental health. They can be employed in lots of different places. We actually care about good government. We care about service to taxpayers. We care about these things, and so when we don't always universally oppose privatization. Privatization can work if there's a robust marketplace with competition, which there isn't so much here because the procurements are so big and so few. It's okay if it's a temporary specialized skill. There's lots of places for private procurements. What we see here is that it just doesn't work well. What you end up with is a staff that's professionally committed. These guys are there for careers, and they're paid a living wage, not a king's ransom wage, but they get their $20,000 or $30,000 a year with their health care benefits. It's a living wage for a hard job, and they do it well, and they care. And what we see in the private sector is they get cut down to $10 an hour. They lose substantial retirement and often health care benefits, and they change, and the Kingpin facility where there's this in Arizona had a different terrifying escape and murder, double murder. And the staff there had an 80% turnover.
Let me ask Harris about that, too.
If our people move to that prison, if they do, it's only until they get a better job.
I want to ask Harris about that, too, because that's a frequent criticism that comes up. And then go back to our listeners, gentlemen. Harris, what about this? I've read this more than once, that one way private companies make money is to have lower paid staff. Lower pay means higher turnover, which leads to public safety threats that Eric described. What do you think? What's the record show on this?
Many prisons are run differently, and there's no universal standard. If the public sector really is concerned about compensation, they can put it in the contract. It's that simple. I mean, if that's the highest concern, and the governor's office and the legislature has brought in a third party and they're all talking about it, if they determine this is our priority, they can put it in the contract. And one quick thing I want to touch on just before I miss it is that it's sort of been implied that because New Hampshire is a small state, New Hampshire can't handle a change. But everything New Hampshire does is small. I mean, if the argument is because New Hampshire is a small state that they can't do policy change, then there wouldn't be a state government. The New Hampshire state legislature and governor's office are completely capable of handling this. And there's over a dozen states that already have more inmates in privately operated prisons right now than New Hampshire has in its entire prison population of around 2,500. So this is not beyond the scope of the state government. And thinking about workers' compensation and turnover rates and worker quality is not beyond the scope of the New Hampshire state government. So I just want to touch on that because I think there's a quiet undermining of sort of what the state's capable of, and I do not think that they're biting off more than they can chew here.
Let's take another call if we could, gentlemen. And Ellie's been waiting in Randolph. Hi, Ellie. Thanks for being on
Hello.
The exchange with us. Good morning.
My name is the Reverend Ellie McLaughlin. I'm a retired Episcopal priest, and I celebrate the Holy Eucharist several times a month, and have been doing so for the last 5 or so years. And I just want to underline my experience of the officers in the Berlin facility who do care. And I've come to know a number of the men such that they trust me and they talk to me, and they are grateful for the way in which the officers do care. But I want to speak to the question of the ethics, the morality of this proposal. And I have before me a review of a new book by a Harvard professor of ethics, Michael Sandel, What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And he talks about the fact that no matter how much our society speaks about the bottom line, there are some aspects of our common life where we will not admit the profit motive. We, for example, don't allow buying children. We still consider prostitution a crime, a sin, because money, with prostitution, money enters into the most intimate sacramental relationship of people who are in love with each other.
So, Ellie, from a moral perspective, a religious perspective, as a religious leader, you say we shouldn't even think about this. Is that your point?
Well, I think we need to think about it because we live in a community in which just about everything is for sale. But I just wanted to mention what Sandel begins with, surprisingly, to talk about the fact that even in this capitalist society, some things aren't for sale.
Off limits. Ellie, thank you for being with us. Harris, this is a big question. I want to turn to both of you and Eric, but Harris, go ahead. You first.
Sure. Well, I mean, water is for sale, is available for profit sale. Food is available for profit sale. Homes, life insurance policies, hospital care. So if the question is, can people make a profit morally, I think the answer is yes. And over important things, the answer is yes. And like I said, the distinction between for-profit private companies and benefit is a really important. Public sector benefits from the status quo. And I applaud New Hampshire for thinking about changing up the status quo. I think this is a good move based on what they're looking at.
Eric, what do you think? Is it fair to say we should just not even consider a profit motive in this situation? It's off limits, as Ellie says.
I think that that's fundamentally right, that liberty should not be for sale, and people should not make more money by having more people in custody. It just shouldn't be that way. And the whole notion of creating a market that wants to have more people locked up, which is really different from wanting to have fewer people committing crimes or more people with good mental health conditions or fewer people addicted to drugs or more people with better education. That's all good. But fundamentally, the market should not enjoy people being locked up. And the last caller, I believe, was from the Episcopal Church. By the way, a coalition in New Hampshire has created a webpage, NewHampshireNHPrisonWatch.org, NHPrisonWatch.org, and it has a lot of data up there. It has the studies that show, as exactly as Harris Kenny put it, he said the research doesn't show a savings, or higher or lower savings. What it really shows is roughly breaking even, a dollar more, a dollar less. All of that is on the webpage, nhprisonwatch.org, and it also collects statements from the faith community. So the New Hampshire Episcopal Church has come out against, but the Presbyterians have come out against, the Catholics have voiced skepticism. There's a collection there on that webpage of statements from the faith community who feels this fundamental sense that you just shouldn't profit from locking people up. And I think that's just moral and profound and real.
Well, we've got at least 20 years now, as one of you said earlier, of examples and research. And Harris, is there one shining example, of where a private prison worked out a really great contract with the state and it ended up working well?
Well, I think one of the best examples of a state that's good at procurement is Texas. And to clarify, I didn't say that all costs are the same. I said that there's studies that look at costs up and down. There's no academic consensus on the cost, public versus private cost. But in Texas, the state legislative review board has published published per diem data that basically is the best apples to apples comparison available today. And that looks at the whole system, and that includes all contracting, and that shows that the private sector does save money. You know, as far as which one prison is the best or not the best, it really depends. It really depends on what the state wants. The market here isn't for locking people up. The market is for justice, and the current vehicle for that is the government, is the state government. And so the customer here is not for locking people up. The customer is the elected officials who voters entrust with justice for their state, for their community.
How did Texas do, Harris, on those other measures that Eric raised, for example, employee turnover and public safety, in other words, the number of breakouts and so forth? Did they look at that as well as the cost, the per diem cost?
They include contracting measures, and the way that they're able to do this is that it's an all-in. So the problem with publicly operated prisons is that, sure, you've got things like if there's a runaway, the state will cover it. The state essentially self-insures. But with publicly operated prisons, what you don't see is things like pension costs, post-employment benefit costs, training costs. It's also much more difficult to lay off a prison guard that's irresponsible or negligent on the job. Whereas with the private sector, in this Texas review, this Texas study, found that what you get is you get an all-in bid, and you know that everything is there on the contract, and you know that all the costs are there. So there's no hidden, sneaky costs, hidden in different state departments, hidden over time, where taxpayers are getting hooked and they don't even know it.
Well, and gentlemen, just to wrap up with you, last question, I think to you, Eric Luckey, first. How would you, if you were here in New Hampshire with us, how would you advise the state as it dips its toe into examining this?
I would look into what are the needs. What do we need? Do we need new capital? Do we need new construction? And then go back to how we satisfy those needs. I think what happened is it kind of went backwards. The RFP was issued, the invitation for bidders to make proposals, with a very wide open way, you know, to give us some ideas. And in some ways, it's a way to shop around and see what things will cost. But what it did is it put us into this private prisons pro or con debate, instead of in a what's wrong with our justice system and how shall we fix it and what capital needs are needed way. And I want to say one other thing, only because following up with Harris about Texas, and I think he's right. Texas does have a lot of experience at it, and it's a place to look at in a model way. And what you see when you look at Texas is the lots of experience matters, because they keep on changing contracts and adjusting things and altering the prisons and going back and forth in a way that New Hampshire can't do, not because it's not bright or they're not capable, but simply because they're small and they're only talking about one prison. So you don't get the back-and-forth experience like they had in Texas. And with the back-and-forth experience in Texas, they're now doing less of it than they used to.
Less privatization.
Running private prisons. And Arizona required a cost-benefit comparison, and they didn't in their statute, and they didn't do it year after year. And then last year, or in 2010, they did a very rigorous, very careful cost-benefit analysis, and they found that the minimum security prisons broke even, and the median between public prison and private prison, and the medium security facilities, the private prisons were actually a few dollars more expensive, roughly $5 more expensive per person per day, coming out to $1,600 per year. And so at the end, it was really pretty clear by the state's own internal measure that the private prisons were more expensive. And so what they're doing in response the following year is they're trying to remove the requirement that they do cost-benefit analysis. They're trying to hide it.
And Eric, I'm sorry to jump in on you. It's okay. We're getting towards the end, though. I did want to clarify that you've said we have one prison. You're right. The big one is in Concord. We do have a smaller men's prison in Berlin and a women's prison in Goffstown. So I just wanted to get that out there. And Harris, super quick to you, too, as we wrap up. What advice would you give New Hampshire as it begins this process?
I would say keep doing what it's doing. elected officials are asking questions. They're thinking differently. They're wondering, can we do this differently? Can we try something new? Can we bring in best practices? Do we have goals that the private sector can help us reach and meet? And if so, great. Let's partner with them. My impression of the New Hampshire process, even though I'm not based there, is that it's been very thoughtful. And I think that that shows because they're considering privatization. It's not
okay.
Out there.
Well, yeah. Gentlemen, both of you, real interesting stuff. And Eric Locke, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Locke, Senior Research Analyst in the Public Division of the Service Employees International Union. Harris Kenny, thank you for being with us as well.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Harris Kenny, Policy Analyst with the Reason Foundation. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer today is Mike Danielli, under the careful tutelage of Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more there about upcoming shows and get extra links and material. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, the nation's land-grant universities celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Morrill Act, which created our system of public higher education. Later, NHPR President and CEO Betsy Gardella takes your questions and comments. And we end the week with a look at teenage drivers amid growing debate over whether tougher rules for teens would save many more lives. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, each morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Reeves Show is next on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from Dr. Rod Burdett and the Riverview Dental of Concord, dedicated to enhancing your appearance, oral health, and wellness, the practice that listens.